Good afternoon. So, last time, before the exam, which we'll have graded later this week, have a few things that were broken on the first version of the key that we need to fix the grading of. So last time we talked about performance. We talked about, I guess, there's some other things I didn't list here, which we talked about that we might go over, like function, inlining is probably another one. So we talked about function inlining, putting functions inside of other functions rather than having a call to get rid of the overhead of the call. Talked about aliasing, the problem that, well, compilers can do lots of clever things, but sometimes they have to be paranoid that maybe that, you know, that thing which is called rows and that thing which is called sums is, you know, that could point to the same place. Even if it, to a human, wouldn't make sense for that to happen, and that can prevent them from doing optimizations like putting variables in registers where it's obvious to your eye that, of course, you can keep that in a register, it's not going to change. Removing redundant operations from loops. We saw the example of stringlang, which is like the most impactful sort of situation where we're, you know, we could compute something. The compiler can't really know it can do that because it has to know, well, what does stringlang do? In order to do that, we talked about cache blocking. And I believe in the other section that we got to loop unrolling, I don't think we did it here, so that's where I'm going to start today. So any questions about the things we covered last time? And just as a review, so cache blocking, general pattern is you have something where you have some loop over a bunch of indices to access some matrices, and instead you do the loop over pieces of those matrices that fit in cache. And for each of those pieces, you do the same calculation, but just over that subset. So general transformation is whenever we have code where we have some nested loops over some matrices, we can do this transformation and get hopefully better performance because we have cache misses. And for aliasing, we learned that the fix, as far as we're concerned, is, well, if you want the compiler to put something in a register, put it in a local variable. The compiler knows, well, you're telling me to keep the same value even if I do change the memory location, and that lets the compiler take advantage of that register there, even though it might not know that, you know, it doesn't overlap with C. So, questions about stuff from last time? See, confused and void spaces, so not sure. Well, maybe we'll have some later. So, let's talk about loop unrolling. So, loop unrolling is this idea that we're going to take a loop and we're going to transform it to do more stuff per iteration. So, here I have a loop which sums a value, and I'm going to, instead of summing one value from some array, so here, this loop, we can check if we're at the end of the array, so we go to the end of the loop, we add a value from the array, then we increment the index into the array, which is RDX here. Remember that this is RDX times 8, so we're advancing by 8 bytes in the array each time. And here, instead, I'm adding one value, two values from the array, and incrementing by 2. So these both perform the same calculation, assuming our array is an even size. And if it isn't an even size, we could make this work by having some extra code to handle the leftover element that's not shown here. And even though we're doing twice as much work per iteration here, we only have one more instruction. So that's our big win here, is that one more instruction does twice as much work, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 versus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 instructions, one of which should be a jump to the loop. And so it should run faster. And we can also express this in C. So we can do when rolling like this in C, where we transform our code to have our two sums in an iteration and our leftover handling. And we can do this more than twice, we can do it four times, and so on. And well, that seems like a useful thing. And we find that it improves performance up to a point. So here I just did this same unrolling of this sum loop on my laptop, and I got that, well, it got faster and faster up to we hit some limit. And you may notice that, well, we hit this limit, you know, we're at 1.01 cycles per element. So we're summing up, we're checking one cycle and a little bit of extra sum of each element. But when I measure the instructions, this is the instructions that were run, you know, so that counting of number of loop iterations times instructions per iteration, I find out that, well, I'm still substantially decreasing my number of instructions, but that doesn't show up in my performance. So we have this bound, which our book calls a latency bound. We'll talk about what that is in a bit. And basically, we have dependencies, and those dependencies are limiting our performance, even though we have more instructions to do, or less instructions to do, that we're having something like stalling for hazards that needs to happen, and that's what's limiting our performance. So we're going to want to do transformations which get rid of that stalling, which is going to involve reordering our calculation. So this is loop unrolling, and I showed doing it by hand. And this is something that is actually pretty easy for compilers to do. This transformation is very mechanical. You don't really need to know much about what's going on. You just need to identify that there's some I which is being incremented every time. Often we helpfully put it in this for thing so the compiler can find it super easily. But compilers aren't very aggressive about doing loop unrolling. So what's a reason why compilers wouldn't want to always just unroll all our loops? What are some problems with that? Why shouldn't I just, you know, why don't I want my compiler to do this type of thing for every for loop I write in my program? Yeah. Yeah, so our code will get really big if we do this. We're making all our loops four times as big if we do this, and possibly more if we decide that four isn't the right number, but maybe it's 8 or 16. Any other reasons? No one? Yeah. So you're worried about side effects. So we can avoid that. So the compiler doesn't actually have too much trouble with side effects. And the reason why is because when we copy the loop, we copy this whole thing, and we're being sure, and we can tell that this I here, which is the other thing you might be worried about. You might be worried about, oh, we're not actually incrementing I each time. We can tell where I is used, so we can make sure that doesn't happen pretty easily. And if we were worried about that, we could also do something like, instead of having I plus equals 4 here, we could do I plus equals 1, which still saves some instructions. We still save the conditional jump, as long as we know that I doesn't change elsewhere, but if it's right elsewhere, we can deal with that. So it's usually not such a big problem. Conceptually, maybe if I were a global variable, we'd really have to be concerned about side effects. But with I as a local variable, we don't really have to worry about that because the compiler can see exactly where I is used and fix all the usages of I, and can decide not to do this if we have some code in the loop which, like, you know, I equals foo. Like, we can just say, if you see that, don't do loop unrolling. So, but there is another issue, which is, yeah. So you're saying about using the same accumulator, that's an issue for later. So there's something where we'll hurt our performance by doing loop unrolling. Yeah.
Is it a register
spilling? We're worried about register spilling. So can someone tell me what register spilling is? Yeah.
If you used up all the registers that you have available to you, you have to start loading in values that would only register to the stack. So every time you access those data values, you need to join them.
Yeah. So register spilling, using up all the registers, and you have, what was your reason why we would be using extra registers for?
I guess you unload enough, more than you have registers, then.
So the question is, if I roll enough more than I have registers, so this might be true if we had different sums, which we'll get to later, but we don't, so that's not a problem with what we're doing here. It also might be true if we used the registers to, if we loaded AI at the top of the unroll loop or something like that. But generally that's not actually an issue. It will be an issue with things similar to loop unrolling we'll do in a bit. So something else that might be a performance problem besides our code getting really big. Yeah. So you're saying that the processor can't do, the dependencies are a problem. So that is gonna limit our performance. That's why we have this bound here. So maybe what we're doing won't help us, but it doesn't seem like it will hurt our performance. There's an important case where our performance will be hurt. I guess I'm surprised people didn't come up with it. And that's the case where what if this N here is pretty small? If this n is 3 most of the time we're running our function, and our function runs a lot, well, now we're running not less instructions, but a lot more instructions, because we have now this extra check for leftover, and we'll start paying for that. So the other reason why you don't want your compiler to always do loop unrolling is not only will your code get big, but if you have a lot of loops which have 3, 6 iterations, those loops might end up being slower because we have this extra checking that we wouldn't do otherwise. And the compiler, when reading your code, has trouble figuring out often, what could n be? Is n typically 3 or is n typically a million? And that's gonna limit when it's gonna actually do this for you. So you'll often find that you want to do it manually. Or somehow give the compiler a hint to actually do it. Okay, so we have some upcoming performance assignments I'm going to talk about logistically just briefly. So this week we have a lab on loop optimizations, including some stuff with multiple accumulators we'll talk about in a bit. And after Thanksgiving, because we aren't going to have a lab next Wednesday, we're going to have a lab on vector instructions, also known as SIMD, which we'll probably talk about on Thursday. I might start it today. There's also corresponding homeworks. So in previous semesters, these homeworks were partner assignments or individual. This semester, they are individual only. So please do not try to do them in partners. We decided basically that some people were getting a good experience working with partners, but for most people, it appeared that one person was doing the assignment and the other person was just along for the ride. So we decided it probably made more sense to have it be done individually because the assignments didn't have a nice way of being split up into one part for one partner, one part for the other. And were definitely possible to do individually. A significant portion of the class didn't choose to have a partner. So the assignments are 2 image manipulation programs where we're going to give you a version of code which rotates an image or smooths or blurs an image. And your task is to write a faster version of the code which computes the exact same result. So our image has a particular representation. We have a struct representing a pixel, which looks like this. So we have a red, green, blue, and alpha component. Alpha stands for transparency. It's in there primarily, so the size of this struct is a power of 2, which turns out to make things a lot faster. And we're going to represent this as a flat array in the sort of way you saw earlier when we talked about cache blocking. So rotate performs this calculation. This is the actual code. I'm going to explain what RedX is in a second. It's a preprocessor macro. It does this transformation of an image where you have the dimension of the image. The images are always square, so we have exactly one dimension, not two. So questions on this? Okay. So RedX is a preprocessor macro. You probably haven't really seen them or have and forgotten. So preprocessor macros, you can define them taking arguments, and they look kind of like functions. And they are text substitutions. So what the compiler does is before it compiles the code, it takes the pound define and where it's used, and it literally replaces it with this and then goes on with the compilation. And it's really text substitution. So for example, here's my double. I put 3 plus 3 in there. We substitute in 3 plus 3 for x, and we get 3 plus 3 times 2, which is 9, not 12. Because it's really just text substitution. It's not a function. And that means when you see these used in practice, you'll often see what looks like extraneous parentheses, but they aren't extraneous. They're because it's actually text substitution and we need to handle that case. And the macro that we have in the assignment looks like this. So it's an, the idea is we take an x, y, and a dimension, and it does the x times the dimension plus y to do our row column calculation into an index. And the code we give you uses it. Most people use it when they write the assignment, but you don't have to. If you want to write it out by hand, that is 100% okay. Okay. So for all these performance homeworks, the way it's going to work is that you can submit multiple variants of this rotate and smooth function in the file you submit. We will grade on the best performing one across a range of image sizes. You can have multiple variants in there, so don't delete stuff that works. You can just try multiple things. We're going to measure speed up on my machine, not yours. And my machine has a slightly different cache and processor than yours, so we'll have slightly different performance, or possibly very different performance. Because I want you to actually know your results, there is a web viewer for the results after things run. When you upload, we have some script which runs every once in a while, like ideally every few minutes, a little less often when something breaks in the department, like happened last night. And it will show you those results, so you can see like which version did best and how they did on each size after it gets to run, which usually should be like less than an hour, might be longer if we're unlucky. Usually it should be substantially less than an hour. And the grade is achieving a certain speed up on my machine. It's a speed up that I have determined, that I have some version which achieves that speed up, or some multiple versions that achieve that speed up, where if you just do particular optimizations, you're very likely to get there. And usually this threshold is set way, way lower than the maximum possible speed. So you don't have to like get it perfect, you just have to get it good. And general advice for this, so some of the assignments, the smooth assignment in particular, has a really specific advice. Like really, really specific. The rotate assignment is more, you should figure out what's acceptable based on the problem. Generally, try things that are acceptable. Vary numbers. So like if you think cache blocking or loop unrolling is a good idea, you have a number to choose. What are the sizes of the blocks? What are the sizes of the number of times to unroll the loop? Try multiple sizes. There are rules of thumb, like for cache blocking we want to set the cache block size based on the cache size, but that, you know, that might not be the ideal value. And what people do in practice is they just try a bunch of things close to that number. Also note that some things combine well, like loop unrolling and cache blocking are best friends. and you probably want to do them together, and that's true of some other things we'll talk about today. Yes?
What's like the grading criteria? Like, does your optimized version have to be a certain factor of unoptimized version?
So in the assignment, there is a formula. We measure the speed up as the geometric mean of the ratio between the given version and your version. And there's some threshold which gets 100%. So for rotate, I believe as of this morning, which is where it's going to stay, I set it to 3. Based on, I know that there are a bunch of versions which achieve that. So there's a bunch of ways of doing it which will work. 3 times faster, and there's a threshold which gets you 75%, which for the rotate is 1.5 times faster, and we just interpolate in between there. So if you get like 2.8, you're going to get something above a 90, because that's almost to 3, but not quite there. The intention is that it should be definitely possible to achieve 100% without doing anything really tricky. You might need to try a bunch of stuff, but you know, definitely should be possible to achieve 100%. That's the intention of the thresholds. So any other questions? And I guess I should mention, since it's on my machine, You can obviously test on your machines. And generally, we found that as long as you're using the same or similar compiler, like GCC and not Clang, most notably, and on Macs, the GCC command runs Clang. But same compiler, generally, speedups will be in the same general ballpark, but they won't be exactly the same. But you know, generally, if something is twice as fast on your machine, it's going to maybe not be twice as fast, but it's going to be a lot faster on mine too. Maybe not, you know, maybe 1.5, maybe more than, maybe 3 times as fast, but you know, same kind of direction. Okay. So other questions. So earlier in this, so let's go on to talking about this latency bound that we saw earlier. So we had, with loop unrolling, we hit this bottleneck, and we're going to fix that now. And to fix that, we need to talk about how processors really work. And when we mentioned real CPUs, we mentioned that briefly that, well, they're not just pipelines. We have this, we do multiple instructions at once, and we execute things out of order. That we somehow chain, you know, how our pipelines deal with, well, we had this sub-instruction which needs that load to happen. Let's do a bunch of other stuff in between. And we need to know about this in order to reason about why did we hit that bottleneck and how do we avoid it. So let's look at, you know, sort of a high-level view of what a more modern processor design looks like. So here is kind of what a modern pipeline looks like that's designed to implement that out-of-order processing. So what we're going to do is we're going to do our first few pipeline stages just as normal. We're going to fetch instructions, we're going to do our decode, and things like that. But then we're going to put our instructions in this big queue. So we're going to have this big list of instructions that we could run, and we're going to sort of distribute our execute phase. We're going to have all these copies of our execute phase and our memory phase in here. And you know, we might have different ALUs, we might have some 2 ALUs for instructions that do simple calculations, and a 2-stage pipelined ALU for instructions that do more complicated calculations. So like maybe ALU 1 and 2 do additions and subtractions, where ALU 3 does multiplication and division. So what a modern processor will do is we'll fetch multiple instructions per cycle, and we'll get them in this list of pending instructions, and we're going to look at this list of pending instructions every cycle and say, is there an instruction I can run here based on what things I have available? And if there is, we're going to send it down these what are called execution units to actually do the execute or memory step of the instructions. And there's going to be a variety of kinds of execution units here. So some of these might be pipelined, so we can send a new instruction to it every cycle. Some of them might not be. Maybe like this load store box might be our data cache, and if our data cache stalls, we have to wait in line. We have a variety of these units, and we're going to put the results through, and we're going to collect the results in this reorder buffer. So this has all our finished instructions, and it's called a reorder buffer because we have all these instructions that we ran whenever they were available. So we're running them out of order, and we need to put them back in a consistent order. We need to make sure that, as far as I'm concerned, it looks like my program executed in order. So this pending list of instructions that aren't quite finished, we're going to look at this list and we're going to say, is the first instruction I need to finish ready yet? If not, I'm going to keep waiting. And we're going to use this list to handle things like forwarding and squashing. So when we went to forward, we're going to look in this reorder buffer to find the values we need to forward. When we went to squash, we're going to remove things that we've run that we shouldn't have run from the reorder buffer. Finally, at the end, we take things out of the reorder buffer in the order and actually write the results back to the real registers or to the real make them be written to the real memory. So questions about this high-level view. So something to note that might help think about this is that this first part here is in order. This part in the middle runs out of order. Order, which is when we can, when values are ready. So this part in the middle just runs whenever values are ready, we run stuff there. And this last part here is back in order. And these queues and buffers, their purpose is just to take things and let us take things out of order and then put them back in order. So we can have our results actually go to the registers in order. So questions about this high level view of what an out of order processor does?
So the
question is, where does the forwarding happen? So I'm omitting some implementation steps that are rather important here, which help with forwarding. And there's multiple designs for dealing with forwarding. So one possible design would be that you take values from the reorder buffer and use that to forward. A more common design does some processing in the decode stage to make it easier to find the values you need to forward, along with help from the reorder buffer. Yes?
And if I were attaching code are in order, does that mean like in our instruction queue, all the instructions are either like in order?
Yeah, so when I say the fetch and decode are in order, I mean that instructions are put in the instruction queue in the order they appear in the program. They don't go out of the instruction queue in that order, but they're put in the order they appear in the program, except that we do branch predictions. So, in the order they appear in the program, ignoring branch mispredictions. Yeah.
How does the concept of these functional units relate to the idea of multiple cores in the CPU?
So a question is, how does this relate to multiple cores? So each core is going to be doing this. So we have multiple kinds of parallelism we've talked about. So we have pipelining, which is already parallelism. So we can have one thing here and one thing here. And now we have parallelism in that we can have multiple calculations starting in the same cycle within a core. And in addition, we have parallelism in that we can have multiple copies of this whole thing to do multiple what are called threads of execution, multiple different sets of instructions on different cores. So we have a whole bunch of kinds of parallelism all at once. Okay. So let's talk about what the instruction queue might look like. So here I have a hypothetical representation of the instruction queue, and we're going to record our instruction and its dependencies, which we figured out somehow. As I said, I'm skipping over the real ways we actually track dependencies in these out-of-order processors. You probably would learn that in 4330 if you took it. There are some techniques which are kind of elegant, which make it not as much of a nightmare as it might seem at first glance, but we're not going to have time to explain them, most likely. But we somehow figured out what the instructions depend on, what values they're waiting for, you know, based on their dependencies, and we're tracking this in our instruction queue. And what we're going to do at any point in time is we're going to say, let's look through this list, find a ready instruction, and try to run it. And in this case, I'm saying, to keep things simple, I have two ALUs, which can perform any instruction, and they take one cycle to do each one. So first I'm going to say, okay, I have one instruction that's ready, I'm going to run it during cycle one. I have a second ALU, but that's no help to me because I don't have any instructions to give it. And this is the problem we were having with our reaching that bound in loop unrolling, is that we had extra processing power we weren't using because there just wasn't instructions to use it with. So that runs, that starts, and it finishes, and now we update and we say, okay, well now this second instruction, which was depending on instruction one, it's ready, the value of RDX it needs to read is available. So now that's ready, and for cycle two I say, well, let's run all the ready instructions that we can. Well, there's still only one. So still not using my second ALU. I've got two of them, but can't really use them. Then we run instruction three. And then after instruction three runs, we update which things are ready, and we find out, oh, now I finally have two instructions that are ready. So I can use both of those ALUs. So rather than just using one ALU, I'm going to use two at the same time. So I'm going to just put one on the other. That's going to finally get to take advantage of having multiple copies of these execution units. And I finish those. And I figure out what's ready after that, and I find out, oh, I can figure out whether my conditional jump was as I predicted, and I can also run this second add. So I run two things then I figure out what's ready here, and so on. Okay, so questions on sort of the mechanical procedure I followed here to run all these instructions. Yeah. So the question is, what if I had more than two things ready? Then I'm going to have to choose two of them to run because I can't run more than two with only two ALUs. And you know, there's multiple choices. Probably you choose the first two, but maybe it would be reasonable to make a processor which does something different. Yeah. So yes, so the question is, why can we run 4 and 6 at the same time? So if we look at 4 and 6, 4 just needs the result from 3, and 6 just needs the result from 3, because nothing that was 4 or 5 changes RDX, and nothing that we see in this whole picture changes RDX, so there's no other data dependencies. Yes? So the question is, aren't we changing the condition codes? Yes. So the assumption here is when figuring out these dependencies, we've somehow dealt with the condition codes in some way I'm not showing. Typically, the way this happens in real processors is that they basically turn the condition codes into a register and do forwarding on that and have multiple copies of it lying around. The copies for each after each instruction, basically. And this is a reason why, if you remember when we talked about risk, we said that risk people don't like condition codes. This is one of the big reasons why people who design instruction sets these days might not want to put condition codes in them, is implementing these out-of-order processors with condition codes. Okay. Other questions? So, since we see how this process works, there's something we can do to help analyze, you know, the performance based on this process. And I'm going to draw a graph. And this is called a data flow. It's called a data flow because I'm showing where information flows. We have instruction one, where we take RDX, give it to instruction two. We take its RDX, give it to instruction three. Then instruction three gives its RDX to instruction four and instruction six. So I've just drawn this as a graph, where I have lines from something to its data dependencies. And an observation we can make is that if we had an infinite number of functional units, if we had, you know, 1,000 ALUs, the best we could possibly do is going down this chain one at a time, you know, for everything, basically like a breadth first search. It's the best we could possibly do. And that means what really matters is what's my longest path from start to finish. Because all along that path, I need to do the first thing, then the next thing, then the next thing. One at a time, I can't do them in parallel because they have data dependencies. And because of that, the longest path determines our speed. And this is what our book is talking about when they talk about a latency bound. That we have to go down that longest path, and we have to pay for the latency. So we have to pay for the latency, the amount of time it takes from start to finish to do instruction one, then instruction two, then instruction three, then instruction six, seven, eight, and nine. That's what determines the time we take. And when we have enough extra execution units, we don't need to worry about this because this will just happen in parallel, and it's the longer path which matters. That we had enough extra time to do that compare and jump. So it didn't actually determine what our performance was. So questions about this concept? So this is a useful, like, quick way of looking at a sequence of instructions and saying, how fast can this run? Without actually going through the process we just went through here, where we looked at every single instruction and accounted for the state at all times. But it doesn't deal with something like one of the questions we had earlier, like what if we had three instructions ready? This doesn't account in only two ALUs. This doesn't account for that, but that's usually not a problem. So let's talk a bit about these execution units, now that we know about how we actually send information to them. And as I mentioned here, these are sometimes pipelined and sometimes not. So if they're pipelined, they might accept a new instruction, a new operation to do every cycle. If they're not pipelined, then, well, we give something here, and as long as it's working, you know, as long as we're loading from memory in our data cache, we can't ask to load another thing. So this is our pipeline picture. So this is my ALU. You know, so here I have an ALU where it takes three cycles to get a value. And I can put in one operation every cycle. So with this ALU, how long do I need to compute this? A times B times C times D with the order of operations shown. I'll give you a minute, check answer with your neighbor. Someone have an answer? They're willing to volunteer? Okay. Three? Three what?
Three, like,
stages, I guess. So I went in cycles would be great.
Okay.
Three cycles, so I guess I'm asking for the latency, by the way. So what's your proposal for how we compute this?
So you have the one multiplication first, the c times d.
Okay.
And then you have the b times c times d, and mm-hmm. you have the a times.
So we have do this one here,
yeah.
Then this, and so what our timeline is going to look like is I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm just going to write time numbers on the top. So we're going to start our C times D. So we're going to start it here. And when is it going to finish? So we're putting C times D in here. And during the next cycle, it's going to get to here. And then it's going to get to here, and then it's going to get to here. Make sense? So that's going to take three cycles, and then we'll have a result. And then, as you said, you want to do the b times. And so it's exactly the sequence you described that we have to do. So we have do that, and then we do the a times. We do that, and we end up with nine cycles, because we have to do three multiplications, one after the other. So that's nine cycles, even though we could squeeze in like some extra calculation like right here. We could, like, because it's a pipelined ALU. So even though this can do one calculation per cycle in throughput, with this particular operation, because of data dependencies, we end up doing one every three cycles. Okay. So how could we improve this? Yeah. Okay, so what would be a proposal for changing the order of the multiplication?
Do A times B and C times D.
A times B. And C times D at the same time. So we end up with A times B, the quantity, times C times D. And in that case, we end up taking, we do A times B and C times D. We start A times B, cycles 1, 2, and 3. And in parallel, we do C times D. And then we have three extra cycles to finish up. So we end up taking seven cycles. And the reason is that in this case, if we do A times B, then, and I should write this possibly readable. C times D, if we do C, we can do A times B and C times D at the same time. So because we have a pipelined ALU here, we start one, and then the next cycle we start the other. We don't need to wait for the result, even though it's not available. So questions about this? Yeah.
How come C times D doesn't start also at one? Because A times B starts at one.
So the question is, why doesn't C times D start at one? Because this execution unit I wrote here says we can only input one set of values per cycle. Yes?
How is that like affecting that critical path?
How is this affecting the critical path? So the critical path was, let's talk about what type of critical path are we talking about, like the processor. So these are separate pipeline stages, so we only care about, like, as long as this fits in a cycle, we're fine. So as long as we're comfortable setting our clock cycle for whatever this ALU needs, it doesn't change our critical path. Does that make sense? So the critical path parameter for a pipeline processor is just how much time between pipeline registers. And basically we're saying that we have a pipeline register here and a pipeline register here, so it doesn't really map. So the effect of having this type of ALU on our critical path, as long as we make the ALU be split up into pieces which are small enough, is fine. You know, it doesn't change anything. Okay. So another type of functional unit you might have, and common case for this would be like a divider, is that we have something where we input some values and it's not always ready for the next input immediately. So we might need to wait a variable amount of time. This is something out of order processors are better at. If some instruction takes a variable amount of time, like a data cache or a divider, we can wait for that ready signal, and immediately when it's there, we can put in the values. When it's not, we're just going to have them wait in the instruction queue, even though they might be otherwise ready to run if we just don't have a place to execute them. So that's on functional units. Okay. So now that we know about how these processors work and these functional units, and we know about this idea of the longest path, we can use this analysis to figure out what was going on with our loop. So in the ideal case here, this is I've laid out the operations for our loop. So let's say we have our A plus I, and we just need to keep adding to it. I'm assuming that the compiler turns it into pointer arithmetic, which is faster, also easier to write in the slide. And we load the value, compute the next address, add to the sum, load the value, compute the next address, add to the sum. So I've drawn out graph. We can see our longest path is basically take the A plus I, load sum, or something variant of that. And so that's going to determine our performance. And in the ideal case, if we had enough execution units, we could do three things at once with this on average. We could be adding to the sum, adding to the address, and loading a value all at the same time. And this is, in fact, something that modern processors can achieve. They have enough execution units that they can do these three operations all at the same time. And if they each take one cycle, which they do on a modern processor, assuming you have all cache hits, then that's performance you can actually achieve. But what limits our performance is that we need to do these additions one at a time. So even if we have the capability of doing, say, an extra addition every cycle, we can't take advantage of it because doing these three things a cycle is our limit. We still have to wait for all these additions to happen. So the book calls this a critical path for our instructions, in contrast to the critical path for our processor. And the time we need to execute this is at least the sum of these latencies. So assuming we have an infinite number of execution units, so we don't ever have to worry about something being in the instruction queue and not being able to run it, it's still the case that we need to wait for this addition, then this addition, then this addition, then this addition. And that's what made us be limited at this 1.01 cycles per element, is that we needed to sum up each element, we need to do that in one cycle, then add the next sum of the next, and that gave us that performance exactly. And we had some other operations going on when we did loop unrolling, like comparing to see if we're done, but these were just all, these are things that weren't part of that longest path. So they ended up not mattering as long as we had few enough of them that we didn't run out of execution units. So questions on this idea? So we're going to take advantage of that trick we just talked about with changing the order of operations. So just to make sure we understand that, let's go through the same example we saw before, but let's say we have a 5-cycle latency multiplier. And as a way of figuring this out that might be easier, you can start by drawing this version of the picture for the operation, that sort of graph of operations. Who needs more time? So, who can share answers for either of them? No one. Oh, sorry, yeah.
15 for the first, 11 for the second.
So 15 for the first one? So how did you get that?
So if you draw the chart you did, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm. So 15 here, and this is because you're saying that we do A times B, B times C, B times the thing, and or C, the thing times C, right? I remember which one example this is. And we do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 after that, and we end up getting 15, that we have to do them one after the other. And another way we could have approximated this very quickly, or quicker, for me at least, I don't know, maybe not for you, is you can say, what's the longest path in this graph? Well, it goes through 1, 2, 3 multiplies, so, and each multiply takes 5 cycles, so it's going to be about 15 cycles. And you said for the other one,
it's 11.
It's 11, and that is right. And we could have gotten a quick approximation of this by saying, oh, it's 1, 2 multiplies on our longest path, that gives us 10. And that wasn't quite right because we really want to start this multiply and this multiply at the same time, but we can't. So we have to use at least another cycle. So the pattern is that we have A times B and C times D. We start A times B, then we start C times D, and after both of those finish, we can start the final multiply and this is how we end up with 11 cycles. But you can see that this data flow model, this drawing the graph and looking for the longest path, was a lot easier than figuring out that schedule, or at least will be if I gave you an example with, like, instead of three instructions, like, you know, 10 or 20. You know, you could actually do the graph. You probably wouldn't want to do that picture. And it gives you a pretty close approximation that just neglects that, you know, we don't always have as much copies of the functional, of like the multipliers and the adders as we'd like to have. So, questions about this? Okay, so we're gonna apply this idea to our loop by getting a better data flow here. And here's my better data flow that I'm going to compute two sums, and then I'm going to combine them at the end. So now I'm adding up six numbers, and I'm doing like separate array indexing for each. I'm hoping my compiler figures out to do this pointer arithmetic so I don't have a dependency there. And it ends up that I get, you know, I can have six things potentially I could do at a time. You know, ideally, maybe that won't happen. Maybe it will run a little slower than that. And my longest chain, though, if I do that quick analysis, is around seven adds worth. That I'm doing, you know, I'm doing seven adds and four adds of time. So I have four adds of time to do seven adds. So I'm getting, taking advantage of the fact that, well, my processor probably can do two adds at once, but to take advantage of that, I need to make sure the adds are not chained together, so they have to happen one at a time. And this rearranging of my sum does that. And this is what our textbook calls multiple accumulators. It's very related to the idea of just changing the order of operations, so we have more things to do at once. I've effectively changed the order of operations for the entire loop's calculation. Yes?
Would this have a worse cache hit rate?
The question is, would this have a worse cache hit rate? The answer is no, because assuming, so if you imagine it works like this, then I'm doing this load and this load are the same. I would have been loading this, then this, then this, then this, and we'll execute them in the same order. So it should be exactly the same. It might be a little different in practice because we won't quite do it in order, but it's going to be very close. So other questions? And so this is what the code for that looks like, that I have two sums, I add them up at the end, and I'll have to handle the leftover. And again, this is something that conceptually the compiler could do. This is harder for the compiler to do. The compiler needs to know it's okay to reorder the operations, which is not always a trivial thing to know. And it needs to know that your loop is important enough and has enough iterations that it's actually going to help you, and that the extra code is going to be worth it. And we have more extra code here because we have this summing up at the end that we need to do. So generally, compilers will very rarely do this. Sometimes they will. And you'll have to do it yourself. And we'll, you know, extremely rarely do it with floating point, where they really don't want to reorder operations because of rounding issues. And this ends up helping performance. So I took my 16 times unrolled loop of the sum, added multiple accumulators, doing one, so just there's one sum, two sums where I just alternated. So I did sum 1 plus equals, sum 2 plus equals, sum 1 plus equals, sum 2 plus equals, added them up at the end, 4, 8, and I'm running this on over 900 elements, so I don't have to worry about the extra time at the end affecting much. And you can see that even though I was using more instructions here, a little more instructions because I had the extra work at the end to sum up the final result, it ends up being a lot faster because I can actually do two sums at once. You can also see that I hit this wall here that I can't get faster than 0.57 on the machine I tested this on. And you might say, that's a really weird number. I'll talk about where that comes from in a bit. So one thing that comes up though is that I keep doing this, and with loop unrolling, we just hit a plateau that our performance stopped improving. Probably it would have hurt eventually when we ran out of instruction cache space, but 16 times is not actually that much because the loop is really small. It's like one instruction. Right? That's not an instruction cache issue. But we have this real problem here, and it's not because I was running out of instruction cache space. So what was happening here? Yeah. Register spilling, which is what I mentioned earlier, is that we ran out of registers. And the reason we needed lots of registers in this case is because in the 16 code, I had some 1, some 2, some 3, some 4, and so on. I had some 16 some variables. And we want the compiler to keep them all in registers, but I don't have that many registers in x86. So the compiler needed to put them somewhere else, and it needed to use space on the stack. That required both extra instructions and extra time to access the data cache to retrieve those values from the stack and put them back on the stack. And this is even though they were probably all cache hits, that didn't matter. We still needed the time to access the data cache and take values in and out of the stack. And you could see this like if you looked at the assembly, which, by the way, is the secret advice for doing optimization that no one in this class follows, is read assembly of your compiler. Sometimes it tells you things. Yes, it is hard to read, but you know, if something weird's happening, the assembly is how you might find out. And for register spilling, it's pretty clear in the assembly. You know, if that's happening, you'll notice, like, oh, why is the compiler using the stack all the time? Or a bunch. Sorry, this is the 8 accumulator assembly, which doesn't have register spilling. When we look at the assembly for the 16 version instead, you can see the register spilling shows up like this. We have an extra move where previously we were just doing an add. We kept each of these variables in registers here, but when we ran out, the compiler did this. It used the values on the stack. So we had the extra cache accesses, and also, well, we didn't actually have any extra ALUs to use. We had already exhausted the number of ALUs my processor had, so having these extra accumulators didn't help for that reason. Like, even if we didn't have to access the data cache, we just didn't have more adds we could do per cycle. We were already filling up all those ALUs. When we think about our instruction queue, we had like 16 ready instructions and 4 ALUs to put them in. So we ended up starting 4 per cycle, which was the same we had with 8 accumulators. So I promised I would tell you about this 0.57. So can someone tell me any idea why is the 0.57 the limit I got? So 0.57 cycles per element. So not like 2 elements per cycle, but a little less than 2. What was happening here? It has something to do with one of the other numbers on this slide. Yeah?
Maybe it was 15 registers that were available and one register spilled.
So the question is 15 registers available when spilled. This is with 4 accumulators. And your argument, though, is maybe there's some register spilling happening. So I did look at the assembly, and there was no register spilling with 4 accumulators. So there was a different thing happening. And this is a very tricky issue. So I was, as I said, I was using at this point all my ALUs. And my ALUs are needed to do the summing and the address computation and the loop's bounds checking. And the loop bounds checking requires some instructions. And when I looked at the loop, here's what I had. I had 2 additions per each element. I needed to add to the sum, and I needed to compute the address. And I had, for every element, 3/16 of, you know, add, subtract, and compare instructions, and a branch. So I had a 16th of an instruction for every cycle that needed to use an ALU, because it turns out on my processor I need to use one of those execution units to run the add, subtract, compare, and branch. And that's where that extra 0.07 came from, is that I had still had to run the instructions that incremented I and compared it with the bounds and so on. And I was just using all my ALUs all the time, and I was just dispatching as much as I could, what our book calls the throughput bound. And this is the limit I could do with how much loop unrolling I did. And this tells me that maybe if I did more loop unrolling, I could get that 0.57 down to like 0.53. Because instead of having a 16th of an instruction extra to run per element, I'd have, you know, a 32nd of an extra instruction to run per element. Or I guess a fourth of an instruction, because I can add 3/16 plus 1/16 is 1/4. So instead of having a fourth, I'd have an eighth of an instruction total to run per element, where I need to do the add of the loop index and so on. So that 0.57 was just like how many instructions did we have divided by how many were we running? And that was because I did this all with 16x loop unrolling, and I just added the accumulators, but the loop unrolling didn't change. Okay, so questions about multiple accumulators? Yes?
What do you mean by
the branch? The branch, I mean the JXX instruction. So other questions? Yeah.
Maybe I'm just blanking, but the last equation, doesn't that come out to 2.4?
Is this equation wrong? So this should be 2.5 divided by 4, 2.25, right? Divided by 4, I believe. Okay, yeah. I hope it's not wrong because I used this slide in the prior semester. But maybe people often don't actually check my numbers. Okay, other questions? Okay. And I guess something notable here is that a phenomenon you'll see often with optimizations is that when you do one optimization, it makes another one better. So like before we did multiple accumulators, it looked like doing more loop unrolling wouldn't do anything. And after we do multiple accumulators, now more loop unrolling can help again, because we've exposed, you know, we've actually started making the overhead of the loop matter again by making the summing faster. And that's sort of the trade-off which happens is you make one part of your program faster, and it ends up that this makes, you know, when you make it faster enough, then the other part matters again, even if it didn't before. And this especially happens because things happen in parallel. So if you're waiting on something slow and you make that slow thing faster, now you'll be waiting on something else that was previously just happening at the same time and you didn't notice. Okay. So in my last 5 minutes, I have a note about comparing loop unrolling and cache blocking. And I'm talking about this because we've noticed in the past that people have often done things on the performance assignments where they think they're doing loop unrolling and they're actually doing cache blocking. Which is great. You know how to do cache blocking and you don't even know it. But we would like you to know whether you're doing cache blocking or loop unrolling. And they do combine well, and usually they're doing both of them. So here I have something where I did cache blocking in K. So I'm working on these 1 by 1 by 2 blocks of everything. And I just have this cache blocking in K I added here. So previously this loop would have been K plus equals 1, and I get rid of this for innermost for loop. And that was my cache blocking. So that makes sense. So I started from having 4, 4, 4, and C. Just the 3-4 loops, and I added the blocking in K, which is why I have the K plus equals 2 at the top, and an inner loop over pairs of K elements. blocks. So this is cache blocking where the shapes of my blocks are 1 by 2, my matrix blocks. And I can combine this with loop unrolling, where I just unroll this loop, unroll that innermost loop. So this is cache blocking and loop unrolling. It's not just loop unrolling, because if I did loop unrolling, I would have been doing J and J plus 1. And that's not what I did here. And notably, let's say I had to worry about aliasing. Well, I can't do the transformation from my original triple E nested for loop here to this or to this. This assumes A and C, A and B and C don't alias. So it's not just loop unrolling. With loop unrolling, we wouldn't have that problem. But here, to make this work, we have to assume there was no aliasing going on. Otherwise, we'd have to worry, maybe when I'm modifying C, I'm also modifying A, and I'm changing the order I'm reading A. And that would be bad. So questions on this? I have some more examples. And I can show you the same thing with more variables. So here I have blocks where I change K and I. So I have a block. So in C, I'm doing I have a 2 by 1 block. In A, I have a 2 by 2 block. In B, I have a 2 by 1 block of the matrix I'm using as my cache block. And I can, partially unroll this. So this is combining the two, which is a very common thing to do. But, this is not, neither of these are just loop unrolling. And to make this clearer, let's talk about what loop unrolling with K would look like. Loop unrolling with K would look like the bottom. That's loop unrolling. So here, down here, this is loop unrolling, where I'm loop unrolling K. This is cache blocking followed by loop unrolling. So because to get this, I first needed to have a loop here, a for loop here, that I could unroll in K. And that didn't exist originally. I had to do cache blocking first to get there. And maybe, often people will just write this code code up here directly, and that's fine. You can write this code directly, but what you're doing is cache blocking, then loop unrolling. If you just did loop unrolling over K, it would look like this. You're doing two copies of the K loop. That's probably not something you should do, because it doesn't really make sense to optimize the outer loop. Questions on this? And one last note about cache blocking and loop unrolling is that something that's handy to do once you've done cache blocking and loop unrolling together is to also, we talked about getting rid of redundant loads. They all combine together. They're all great. Do them all. So you can prevent aliasing here, as in prevent the compiler from thinking aliasing happening by using local variables, along with cache blocking and loop unrolling. That's all of them together. That's something that is a very common, so all these optimizations we've talked about are really complementary. So that's what I have for today. So next time we'll talk about some miscellaneous optimizations and vector instructions.